From Port Allegheny to La Trobe, Lebanon to Erie, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Pennsylvania gave President Donald Trump a big electoral win and helped propel his return to the Oval Office. This time, mail-in balloting played a big role. Cliff Maloney, founder of the Pennsylvania Chase, is here to explain how it was done. The city of Pittsburgh will not raise property taxes this year, but the fiscal future looks grim. Eric Montardi and Alex Sodini have an Allegheny Institute report. And Washington has acted. Now it is time for Pennsylvania to unleash our energy future. Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity talks about it on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Cliff Maloney of the Pennsylvania Chase in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. In addition to the inauguration of President Donald Trump, three Pennsylvania statewide elected officials were sworn into office this past week, and for the first time ever, the GOP holds all three of the Commonwealth's constitutional or row offices. Former York County District Attorney Dave Sunday took office as Pennsylvania's new Attorney General. He joins State Treasurer Stacey Garrity and State Auditor General Tim DeFore, who were reelected last November. The three were part of a statewide red wave that included President Trump winning the state's electoral votes. As Groundhog Day rapidly approaches, the political version of the iconic film, which saw the main character repeatedly waking up to Groundhog Day festivities in Punxsutawney, continues to play out in the courts. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court will once again take up the issue of whether voters should be required to write the accurate date on return envelopes when they mail in ballots. The U.S. Supreme Court this past week refused to hear an appeal alleging the requirement violates the 1964 Civil Rights Act. State courts, including the state Supreme Court, have ruled multiple times on the issue. This time, the court will decide. While three of the sitting justices face retention elections this year, leading to questions as to whether they should recuse themselves from participating in the decision. President Donald Trump has issued an executive order rescinding former President Joe Biden's pause on permits needed to build new liquefied natural gas facilities. The move paves the way for potential LNG export terminals to be built near Philadelphia, opening up foreign markets for Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale gas producers. American Petroleum Institute CEO Mike Summers termed the move, quote, an incredible American energy opportunity. On a sad note, State Representative Matt Gergely of Allegheny County, who had been hospitalized after suffering a medical emergency several weeks ago, has passed away. Gergely was first elected to the House in 2023 in a special election. Another special election will be held in March to fill the remainder of his current term. In the meantime, the House of Representatives, again, falls into a 101-101 partisan tie. Our sympathies go out to Representative Gergely's family, friends, and colleagues. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Democrats secured electoral victories in 2020 on the strength of mail-in ballots. In 2024, Republicans showed up to compete. Among the most successful efforts in the nation was the Pennsylvania Chase. Cliff Maloney is founder of the Pennsylvania Chase and is CEO of the Citizens Alliance. He is here to talk about mail-in balloting and its future in Pennsylvania elections. Cliff, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Cliff, when we talk about the Pennsylvania Chase and its role in improving the number of mail-in ballots that Republican candidates received this past year, so that our audience knows what we are talking about, I want to talk a little bit about mail-in ballots, their history, and what the process is.
In Pennsylvania, I really try to get people to understand that these are new rules, right? Since 2020, when the COVID hit and we decided to change the rules, both Republicans in the legislature and I believe it was Tom Wolf at that point as governor, we now allow for 50 days of voting. And I think a lot of people in Pennsylvania understand that, but a lot of people don't. And so the Democrats adapted immediately, while Republicans kind of refuse to play by the new rules. And I think this cycle, 2024, obviously we changed that. You had tons of organizations. You had the state party, you had the RNC, you had Trump's campaign, all of the local campaigns, federal, state, they all understood we have to compete in the mail-in vote portion of the campaign. And I think the results show us that Republicans finally decided to pony up and actually compete.
Taking a look at that then, what was the percentage increase in Republican participation? And I guess Republicans didn't outvote Democrats in mail-in ballot, but the percentage got significantly better?
Yeah, well, when we launched the PHAs, I mean, we said that we clearly put out a number and said that Republicans have averaged 20% when you look at Republican versus Democrat mail-in votes, right? So how many votes? I'm talking about for the candidate. Right. If you look at Republican versus Democrat in any of the statewide elections since 2020, we've gone into the election on average down 60 points. It's 20 to 80. Right. So we said, look, we modeled this out. And at Citizens Alliance, we said, look, this PHA's program, if we can go from 20 to 33%, Trump getting 33% of the mail in versus Harris, we think he wins handedly. He probably could have won with 30%, but 33% was our public goal. And I'm happy to report here on your show, Loman, Trump received 34.5% of the mail-in vote after we knocked 510,000 doors chasing those requests and chasing those ballots. So to put it simply, it worked.
It absolutely did work in the presidential race. But Cliff, as you look at what happened down ballot, not only with the presidential race, Republicans took all three statewide constitutional or row offices. There were, two seats in the U.S. House of Representatives that flipped Democrat to Republican. Did this effort, the Pennsylvania chase, ripple its whole way down the ballot?
Yeah. So what we did is we looked for what we call double dips, right? And so what I mean by that is Trump's on every ballot. McCormick, Garrity, Sunday, DeFore, all the statewide, they love us because we're knocking 500,000 doors and they benefit from every door we knock. And so what we did was we looked which areas can we focus in on, right, and consider it a double dip because there's one, two, maybe sometimes even three or four. I mean, heck, you look at York County, there's something in the water out there. I mean, they've got great candidates up and down the ballot. And at Citizens Alliance, we're looking for principled and viable candidates that we can help. And so at the federal level, you know, obviously McCormick was statewide, but we targeted three congressional districts. With District 7 and 8 that were Democrats that we were trying to flip. And then obviously Scott Perry, who's what I would consider the gold standard here in Pennsylvania, Scott was a top target for the Democrats to eliminate. And so, you know, happy to report on your show, Loman. Like you said, we were able to flip those two blue seats, PA 7 and PA 8, for Bresnahan and McKenzie. And then obviously we were able to defend Scott, which was a vital priority of our entire program. So at the congressional level, we saw great success. We had a couple state Senate seats that we targeted, saw three out of four of those go our way. State House is probably the one area I'd point to where we're still frustrated to see that we didn't take the state House back. But I think in 2026, you know, that's going to be a major, major target. But yes, there was a ripple effect up and down the ballot. I think you saw it in a lot of these areas. And it's about using resources and resource allocation that gives you the most impact. And I think those three congressional races, they show that when we did that, those double dips, it paid off, obviously, for Trump, McCormick, and the other statewides, but we were able to really have an impact in those more local races.
We are talking with Cliff Maloney, who is the founder of the Pennsylvania Chase, also CEO of the Citizens Alliance, and talking about the Pennsylvania Chase. Cliff, tell us a little bit, how does it work? I know you can't give away all the state secrets, but how did you manage to go out and get all those mail-in ballots and get Republicans energized this past year?
Our secret sauce at Citizens Alliance, one of the things we try to focus on is door-to-door. The left has put out tons of literature on this. They've studied this, and I always said for years, Republicans believed in volunteer door-to-door operations, and Democrats believed in volunteer door-to-door operations and paid door-to-door operations. And so it never made sense to me. You know, why are we not mimicking this tactic? And then you see Democrats putting out that, yeah, it's the most impactful way to reach and to create new voters. Now, look, I'm not saying you don't do TV, you don't do digital, mail, radio, or the traditional advertising. Of course, you have to compete with your competitors. But we were failing to compete with door-to-door. And then once all these rules were changed, it's like, my gosh, we absolutely need to do door-to-door in a paid fashion where you can scale it and hit these big numbers and have consistency. So we've always done door-to-door. And so when we launched the PA Chase, if you ask me, what does it look like? We hired 120 full-time ballot chasers. To do that, we had to get 1,100 people apply. To apply, we had to interview roughly 600 to 700 people to get to that number, right? So it is a huge undertaking. It's a huge process, but that's what we do. At Citizens Alliance, we build these huge ground games and what we call permanent infrastructure. And then from September 1 through Election Day, it's very simple. They would go out, all 120 of them, full-time. We put them in 10 Airbnbs across PA, and they would knock doors. Their first door would be knocked at 10 a.m., take an hour for lunch in the afternoon, and then they knocked their final door by 7 p.m. A typical day, you're knocking between 100 and 125 doors. And the conversations at the door, Loman, are pretty simple. For the first month, they're asking people that are low propensity, who are aligned with us. So these are our voters, but they're not likely to vote. We're asking them to request a mail-in ballot. So you're going to their door with a mail-in ballot request form, giving it to them. October 1 through Election Day, which is roughly when a lot of these ballots went out, the conversation changes to, hey, Bob, I know you got a ballot sitting there. And by the way, Loman, all of our data tells us the second that a ballot is sent in, we know. So we know in real time, or at least within a 24-hour lag, if they've sent back their ballot or not. And so they're going to the door. We've got all the data. We're targeting people that had a ballot, and we're just making sure that they are sent back. And I'm happy to report that this was the first election cycle in PA history. So out of the five elections since the rule changes, Republicans had a higher return rate on their mail-in ballots than Democrats. It doesn't mean we beat them with raw votes, but of all the people that requested, we actually had a higher percentage return them. And I give a lot of credit to the full-time ballot chasers that did the work, pushed through it, despite MSNBC and CNN saying that we were an astroturf, fake, non-existent ground game. I think the numbers do the talking.
You touched on something I think that's very important here, Cliff, and that is in terms of the people who turned out to vote via mail-in ballot. This wasn't just a, oh, we took people who normally vote on Election Day and got them to mail in early. It actually expanded the pie among the lower propensity voters?
Correct. And to be frank with you, Loman, this is the strategy of the left, right? I mean, imitation is the greatest form of flattery. And I don't hide from the fact that this is not some strategy we created, right? But when you see your competitors having success, you want to figure out why. Dig, as Jordan Peterson would say, I want to dig deep here and understand what's going on, right? What's going on in their head? So, yes, the strategy was this. There's roughly a million what we would call low-propensity Republicans. And on the left, there's about the same. A million low-propensity Democrats, at least there were. They were really able to get practically all of them to vote for Biden, which we can talk about some other time. But the idea is there's a million Republicans in Pennsylvania that if you just run normal campaign operations, they're not likely to vote. So they voted in two or less of the last four general elections. Okay, so 0 of 4, 1 of 4, or 2 of 4. Those were the people that we targeted because they're considered low propensity, but they're aligned. So you don't have to persuade them. You don't have to convince them. They're going to vote for Trump. They're going to vote for McCormick. They're going to vote Republican, but they have to vote. And so the left understood this and spent all this time requesting mail-in ballots, getting these people to fill out the request form. And so that's the strategy we took. Like I said, the first month, we were going to these not 3 of 4s or 4 of 4s, right? Not people that are going to vote on Election Day every year. We weren't targeting them. We were talking to people that were not likely to vote, which was the Democrat strategy. Our side finally implemented it, and it led to great results.
Cliff Maloney, the founder of the PA Chase and CEO of the Citizens Alliance. Cliff, is there a website where folks can go if they want to learn more about the Citizens Alliance and the Pennsylvania Chase?
Yes. If folks go to teamcap.org, that's T-E-A-M-C-A-P, teamcap.org. They can check it out. We'll have links there to get you to the PA Chase. If you're looking to run for office, you can fill out a candidate form, whether it's 2025 or if you're prepping for 2026. And of course, Loman, one of the most important things we do at CAP, specifically in Pennsylvania, is our candidate academies. So if anybody out there is thinking about running for office, I don't care if it's dog catcher or Congress, I don't care if you're looking to run or you want to run a campaign, meaning staff. We're always looking for people that are aligned.
Cliff Maloney, founder of the Pennsylvania Chase and CEO of the Citizens Alliance. Cliff, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Always appreciate you being a patriot, Loman. Take care.
The good news for City of Pittsburgh taxpayers is there will be no property tax hike this year. But the city's fiscal future isn't so bright. For details, we turn now to Eric Montardi and Alex Sodini of the Allegheny Institute for this Allegheny Institute report.
Hello, and welcome to the Allegheny Institute report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is Alex Sodini, research associate at the Allegheny Institute. Alex, recently, Pittsburgh City Council approved 2025's operating and capital budgets. The mayor signed them not long after. Could you give our listeners an idea of how much those budgets plan to spend?
The operating budget includes $665.6 million in operating expenditures, which is slightly less than last year, and there are $120.6 million in capital expenditures, which is about $40 million less than last year. This budget was particularly of note because this was the first year since the introduction of ARP funds that the operating budget would not be able to draw on relief from the American Rescue Plan dollars. So in terms of operating expenditures, that $665.6 million is comprised of $291.1 million in salaries, $61.7 million for health benefits, $13.6 million for workers' comp, $112.5 million for pension and other post-employment benefits, and then $112.7 million for operating departments and $73.9 million for debt service. In terms of the capital budget, the capital spending includes 44% of that will be on engineering and construction, about $53 million, $38 million on facility improvements, $9.3 million on administration and awards, $8.5 million on community development, and then roughly $6 million each for vehicles and then public safety.
Are taxes going up in 2025? And where does Pittsburgh collect most of its revenue from?
Taxes are not scheduled to go up as there is no millage increase in this budget. Tax revenues are projected to reach $530.3 million, which is about 79.3% of the total revenues. This year is important as the wage tax is expected to overtake property taxes as the highest source of revenues. So this year, the wage tax is budgeted for $145 million in revenue, and the property taxes are budgeted at $143.9 million in revenue. Last year, the real estate tax was at $151.9 million, and the wage tax was at $136.2 million.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of appeal activity, especially on skyscrapers in downtown Pittsburgh, which we've talked about previously. And the wage tax, of course, falls on the earned income of Pittsburgh residents, and with inflation and how that affects wages, you can see why that revenue source is expected to go up and surpass property taxes this year. Alex, can you tell us a little bit about the other revenues that the City of Pittsburgh collects, what they refer to as non-tax revenues?
Absolutely. The non-tax revenues make up the remaining $138.5 million of the revenues. Intergovernmental revenues and charges for services account for $96.5 million of that. So that's, of course, money they are getting from other governmental entities and then charges for services that the city is providing. Miscellaneous revenues, importantly, declined $46.6 million, which was due to the expiration of ARP funds. And so overall revenues decreased 6.4% compared to 2024.
How many employees is the city budgeting for, and are there any major changes to departments in terms of employee count?
In terms of the total headcount for the 27 departments that comprise the general fund, the city is budgeting 3,278.75 employees. This is down 54 from 3,332.75 employees in 2024. The largest budgeted reduction in terms of headcount is 50 uniformed police officers, which is going from 850 to 800, though this is partially offset by an increase in 16 civilian police positions. Additionally, the Public Works Bureau of Operations headcount will decrease 30 from 316 employees to 286.
Pittsburgh is required to have its fund balance at a certain level. What's the requirement, and how will Pittsburgh do on that requirement through the next 5 years?
The city code requires that Pittsburgh have the ending fund balance as a percentage of its total expenditures to be at least 10%, and ideally there would be a goal of 12.5 to 16.7%. Looking at 2025, the ending fund balance as percentage of expenditures is supposed to be 21.9%, which is obviously above the 16.7 goal. However, looking at the revenue forecast for the next 5 years, which the city controller is required to certify under an ordinance passed last year, the ending fund balance will quickly go from above the 16.7% goal all the way down to 10.2%, which is just above the 10% minimum. The controller expressed worries over the revenue streams, as there are a number of issues that could change the revenue forecasts and obviously cast a shadow of uncertainty on the city's ability to generate revenues. The total revenues are projected to grow 6.9%, while expenditures will climb 7%, which is contributing to the declining fund balance. The controller certified the revenues in a memo addressed to the city council finance chair and expressed worries that the city's revenues stream may be impacted over time. As we previously mentioned, the wage tax on city residents is projected to continue to grow due to wage increases and ongoing inflation. However, if the city continues with its population stagnation and or decline, this will of course impact those figures. At the same time, as we mentioned, the real estate tax collections are set to decline, reflecting the ongoing assessment challenges downtown, which have prompted refunds at the city's expense and at the same time lowering future property tax revenues. The controller also emphasized that the city needs to maintain budget flexibility due to the ongoing litigation of the facilities usage fee, or jock tax, which is a fee levied on non-resident performers and athletes at publicly funded venues. If these revenue streams continue to decline, this will obviously have an impact on the city's ability to meet its 10% minimum obligation for the fund balance.
Then at that point, we don't know really what happens. The jock tax has been in litigation for a few years, and the Supreme Court has allowed an appeal by the city on just a very narrow aspect of the ruling, which is how do you treat residents and non-residents who pay a tax because of the uniformity requirement in the state constitution. The city has already said they know that there are lean years coming, this being one of them, and there is no tax increase. What should the city be doing in order to bolster the fund balance and to avoid tax increases?
To bolster the fund balance in future years, the city has two options. They can either increase revenues or they can lower their expenditures. Rather than increasing revenues via tax increases, the city would be better off lowering its expenditures. In the most recent benchmark city analysis by the Allegheny Institute, which is a model city comprised of the finances of Omaha, Charlotte, Salt Lake City, and Columbus, Pittsburgh fared consistently worse than the benchmark city, with its taxation per capita 44% higher, and at the same time, its spending per capita was 42% higher, and the total employee count was 48% higher. There's clearly room for Pittsburgh to lower its expenditures and rein in its overbearing public sector. This would also curb the need for excessive taxation and promote a more business-friendly climate that would help grow the tax base and shore up potential revenue shortfalls in the future.
Great stuff, Alex, and we always encourage our listeners to visit our website, www.alleghenyinstitute.org, to read this brief and others. For Alex Sedini, this is Eric Montardi, and this has been the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
Pennsylvania could be a worldwide leader in energy production if state policies were changed to unleash our energy potential. So says Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal Commentary.
In a recent recording for Americans for Prosperity's American Potential podcast, Toby Rice, CEO of EQT Corporation, one of the country's largest natural gas producers, shared a number that will shock you. When you add up the total oil and gas produced in America each day, that number is equivalent to 31 million barrels of energy per day, more than Russia and Saudi Arabia combined. As a leader in the energy space, Rice's message to Harrisburg and Washington resonates deeply. Let the markets work. Though a simple statement, his words have never been more critical. After 4 years of top-down, stifling control of the energy sector by Washington's executive branch, and many years of cap-and-tax policies from Harrisburg, there's no better time to unleash our Commonwealth's natural resources, which ultimately means that you, ratepayers and consumers, pay less each year. On behalf of Americans for Prosperity, we were elated to see President Trump sign an executive order to unleash America's energy abundance, reversing years of top-down control that hindered our country's potential. With this executive order, this administration signaled their commitment to our energy production as the backbone of our economy. Over the course of the last 4 years, former President Joe Biden left our energy sector in shambles. Through his executive power, Biden doled out billions of dollars of corporate welfare to the renewable energy industry, deemed thousands of acres of federal lands off limits to oil leasing, and, most notably, canceled the Keystone Pipeline project. How did this impact you, the taxpayer? You felt the increase of energy prices by 30%. You, as a motorist, experienced record high prices at the pump. And finally, to heat your home, you endured skyrocketing heating costs. Washington has signaled the desire for change. But now, we must call upon Governor Shapiro and House Democrats to get to work to put a stop to their dangerous energy policies. As executive of our Commonwealth, Governor Shapiro has signaled his support for the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is a conglomerate of states that implement cap and tax policies on CO2 emissions. As CO2 emissions are capped to a certain level, this levies a tax on you, the ratepayer. Even worse, Pennsylvania was entered into the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative by executive order, stripping Pennsylvanians of the opportunity to share opposition through the voices of their representation in Harrisburg. Governor Shapiro could lead with the same enthusiasm as Washington to work to drive down the cost of energy bills, unleashing our Commonwealth's energy innovation along the way. Instead, we see Harrisburg pandering to special interests at the cost of the taxpayer. There's work to be done. Tell the Shapiro administration that you reject cap and tax policies that drive up your energy bills. Join us at AmericansForProsperity.org to get to work today towards a better future for our energy industry. Through your voice, you can help us signal the will of the people to praise efforts to keep energy prices low, while also holding accountable those who promote top-down executive control over energy policies across our Commonwealth and country. Take action today. Your voice is your most crucial tool in the toolkit, so help us send a message to Harrisburg to reject the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative and other top-down policies that burden our Commonwealth's ratepayers. Again, head to AmericansForProsperity.org to learn more. This is Emily Green, State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 30 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WRPV-FM in Clearfield, WIYQ-AM and FM in Saxonburg, along with WRAK-AM in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.
Thank you.